Wimps and posers leave the hall, recording live from the Black Lodge. It's me, the free will burning, head turning, ass kicking, machismo dripping, mouthpiece of the Southeast, insane Brandon Lane. And under normal circumstances, I might be even happy to be bringing this opportunity to hear what I have to say directly from my mouth to your awaiting ears, but tonight is a little bit of a different situation. So I put this poll up on our Facebook group, and first of all, I want to give a nice shout out to those of you who listened to my last podcast, all 9 of you. That's more than I expected, and I realize there's a way smaller percentage that probably listened to the entire thing. In fact, I believe I'm probably the only one who did. All the same, you gotta start someplace. But for the 4 or 5 of those 9 people who voted for the Rise of Cobra, a.k.a. the first G.I. Joe live-action piece of shit movie that we're about to watch, you can all suck a donkey dick until you choke on its jizz, because I am not looking forward to this. I have downed a 6-pack of Yingling, and I've got about 6 more in the refrigerator, so we'll see what happens over the course of the night. So if I die of alcohol poisoning, it's your motherfucking fault. So, in its glorious 1080p resolution, we're going to watch the G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra on Blu-ray. Shout out to Sam Witt, who let me borrow this. But at the same time, I think less of you now, because why in the fuck do you own this movie? I sure as hell don't. And I'm one of the biggest G.I. Joe fans you'll ever meet. Shout out to Chris McPherson, another Cobra man-at-arms. Had lengthy discussions of the pros and cons of the series, you know, from animated form also to live action. And whereas I think the sequel to G.I. Joe Retaliation was not good, but it was certainly a lot better than this movie, I think we're both in agreement that this movie is one hunk of shit. So what we're going to do right now, for the 0 people who will follow along, you got this movie on DVD, which I pity you if you do, put it in, and what we're going to do is in the count of 3, we're going to hit play. 3, 2, 1, play. So whereas what I did in my commentary for Ghostbusters, I didn't have to do any research, and I would say 99% of the things I said on there were pretty accurate. You know, I'm fallible. I'm a human being. I like to say that I'm never wrong about stuff as a joke, but truth be told, I do make a fair bit of mistakes in life. Very few about Ghostbusters. I know shit tons about G.I. Joe as well. As far as this movie, I've only seen it once. This will make the second time, and that's 2 times too many. Me and a good friend and some other people I worked with at the time, We bought tickets in advance. We saw this at Turkey Creek, and I knew this movie was going to be a turd. I knew it was going to be a turd, but I had to see it. It's G.I. Joe. I had waited my entire life to see this in cinematic form. One of my childhood milestones was seeing the animated movie. I don't have to see clear to fracture your rear. Roadblock gets blind, and he teams up with Cobra Commander, who's a snake person. It's a fucking stupid movie. It's got Don Johnson in it and Burgess Meredith, which on paper sounds amazing. No, it doesn't, but for the sake of argument, it sounds amazing. But this. Okay, so here we are, France, 1641. This is giving you some backstory about the Destro character, which is sort of a half and half kind of good thing about this movie. Christopher Eccleston, better known as was he the 8th or the 9th Doctor? You'll have to. I'm not a big Doctor Who fan. The revival series. He did a season, and he's a good actor. He's a very good actor. I would dare say he was even well cast for the role of Destro. But man, why in the fuck? Why in the fuck would he have lowered himself to this? I have to imagine it was for a paycheck. Getting back to what I was saying before about not knowing a lot about this movie, you know, having only seen it once, I did manage to do a little bit of research, which was kind of fun. mostly through the most reliable of sources, Wikipedia. So, unlike my Ghostbusters commentary, if I say something that's wrong, blame it on Wikipedia, because I sure as hell wasn't going to go to the trouble to fact check anything I say. And if I just flat out make stuff up to make this more interesting, that's just to keep my sanity in check. Oh boy, title card, G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra. Fuck me running. In the not too distant future, this movie rapes so many people's childhood. Right off the bat, this movie is wrong, because it has no grounding in the whole basis of the Reagan-era G.I. Joe nostalgia. And that all has to do with, you know, making this movie profitable on a global scale, because everything has to be ready-made for China now. You can't sell a movie on a big-budget scale if it's not going to turn a huge-ass profit in China. I have a Chinese friend, love her to death. Her name is, well, her American name is Bella. She was a J-1 foreign exchange student I met last year. And with all due respect to how sweet a person she is, but fuck you and your country for ruining movies, because now we have to pander to a, granted, huge demographic of people, all for the benefit to turn a dollar. This movie could have been made on a way lower budget and could have made its money back, but that's just how the movies are made these days. Okay, so in doing my research, I consulted IMDb as well, which is a way more reliable source of information than Wikipedia. So hopefully some of these things are correct as well. While we're setting up the whole quote-unquote plot of this movie, some of the more interesting things I came across was a slew of reviews. And I want to preface this by these reviews I'm about to read. These are positive reviews. I didn't even print out the negative reviews, because everything I can say is going to be 100 times worse. But these were positive reviews. Now, granted, I've cherry-picked some of the better ones to make my case that this movie is a turd. But I'm going to read a couple of them right now. Positive review from Jeffrey Lines. A dull, passionless take on a property that any fan could have outdone with half the budget. And he quips, "No Joe." I agree. If you had taken two kids with a toy box full of G.I. Joe, a couple of Rattlers, and, you know, your core Joes, and maybe a set like the USS Flag, and you had literally just recorded him making the shit up on the spot, it would have been slightly more coherent than this movie's plot. In a nutshell, this movie is about a guy who has little tiny robots that will destroy stuff. And it took them, I don't know, what was the budget on this film? I've probably got it listed somewhere in my laundry list of notes. I'll find it later. Someone remind me. Haha, no one's here. But it's insulting. This movie costs so much money and has no business existing. The G.I. Joe animated movie, for all its flaws, and really the animated show is pretty stupid. Let's just be honest. And I am a huge fan of this. One of my favorite comic books growing up was the G.I. Joe comic. So to me, that's the heart and the spirit of it. But to a lot of kids, you know, it was the toys, and it was the television show, the cartoon, the Sunbow animated film, you know, everything prior to the, you know, the Deke releases. But it's objectionably goofy. I mean, on a huge level. For instance, okay, you've got two warring factions, G.I. Joe, a real American hero, and then you've got your international terrorist organization of Cobra. The animation is always inconsistent. Sometimes you have red lasers being shot by the Joes against the Cobra's blue, and then vice versa. I'm just curious, like, how do they coordinate this? Because it's never consistent. So I have to think it's like,
hello, is this Duke?
Yeah, this is Duke.
Oh, this is Cobra Commander. I just wanted to get with you and make sure that our plans for our battle leader are still on.
Oh, yeah, I'm gathering the troops right now.
Okay, just to confirm, are you using the red lasers or the blue lasers? Because I would hate to show up and be so disappointed in you that you forgot to use the correct laser color.
This movie is no stupider than that. So, with this in mind, we've got these poorly CGI'd jets shooting Humvees, and this is not an American force, G.I. Joe. Okay, well, I think it's Ripcord who's Marlon Wayans. I can check that very quickly. I've got the cast list someplace. Yes, Ripcord and Duke are not members of G.I. Joe, and they're transporting these, they're like nukes, I guess. I could probably pay attention and find out, but fuck that. They're transporting these, and they're the Mars Corporation, which is sort of like the precursor to Cobra. Not in continuity with the comics of the cartoon, but in continuity of this film, because Mars Corporation in continuity is goes to the highest bidder. Oh, and here we have Sienna Miller as the Baroness. Wrong on so many levels. She looks nice in the outfit, although she's wearing very much a push-up bra because she ain't got nothing going on up top naturally. I'm getting off topic. But you've got Cobra, or the makings of Cobra, attacking this NATO group. And G.I. Joe is about to show up to even the score to make sure these warheads or whatever aren't taken. Fair enough. You gotta have a setup someplace. The problem with this is that G.I. Joe is an American elite fighting force. Now, they have an international cast of members, cast of characters, but it's not an international group. Half the fun is the ridiculousness of this, you know, the flag waving, you know, Reagan era Rambo 2 nature of it. Team America World Police. That's the G.I. Joe movie that we get. You alter some of the stuff and maybe scale back a little bit of the ridiculousness, and you got a G.I. Joe movie. And a pretty good one. At least based off of terms of the comic book. Oh, and here we go. Here's Snake Eyes. Ray Park plays Snake Eyes. And I've met Ray Park. He was Darth Maul in The Phantom Menace. And where he's the best thing about The Phantom Menace, he's the best thing about this movie. I'm not crazy about his costume. He has this weird molded mouth that I don't really care for. But he's legit as far as, like, you know, martial arts and the fighting and stuff goes, so I don't have a problem with him being in the film. Rachel Nichols plays Scarlet. When I look at her, do I think about Scarlet? No, but I think she looks pretty damn good in that leather body suit she's wearing. This movie's a little more violent than I remember. Maybe it's sort of cartoony, but I've seen a couple people be stabbed so far. So the whole MacGuffin about this is that the Baroness is Duke's old girlfriend or some shit, and it's just some plot convenience they came up with to mask as quote-unquote, and I just did air quotes and no one can see that, but just to punctuate it, quote-unquote character development. Which is laughable, because these are for based off of a cartoon where everybody is a stereotype. and has, you know, no real character development. This movie is super superficial. I made a reference to Roadblock earlier. Roadblock is a very popular character, and he pops up in the sequel, played by The Rock, and, you know, that's an argument for another day. But in this movie, we have Heavy Duty. Heavy Duty is Roadblock's cousin. And why? Why did they have him and not Roadblock? I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Roadblock is an eternally more interesting character, simply off the basis that he rhymes when he talks. Sort of an African-American Dr. Seuss. And, not to dump on the sequel, but you would have thought they could have given The Rock one line, at least one line that rhymed. So, we have some good actors in this movie, and I talked earlier about Christopher Eccleston, and like, him being a credible actor, and how the hell did he end up in this abortion? But then we have Dennis Quaid. And yeah, maybe Dennis Quaid has been in some terrible Meg Ryan movies, but by all accounts, he's a very talented actor. And then here we have him with CoverGirl, who's freaking wasted. CoverGirl was one of my favorite figures as a kid because I had both the blonde and the brown variant. And I guess it's a stupid thing to say as a kid, but a lot of my when I would play with G.I. Joes, a lot of it was Cobra-centric. So some of the G.I. Joe aspects of it were kind of boring because I just didn't care about those characters. I would pretend like CoverGirl would go, and she would infiltrate Cobra. And the way that she would not be noticed is that I would switch from the blonde-haired one to the brown-haired one, because Cobra is pretty defective in their means of figuring out who's who. And that's a stupid thing to say, but you know, I cut me some slack. I was like 5 or 6. Some of the other people in this movie. Brendan Fraser, who he'll show up a little later on. Before I get into that, this CGI is awful. This is supposed to be in Egypt. What is this place called? I have it wrote down someplace. Oh, well. He'll probably say, I know you probably don't care to begin with. But Brendan Fraser, he makes a cameo later on. And that brings me to like who directed this movie. This movie was directed by Stephen Sommers. He did, I think, the first two Mummy movies. He did Van Helsing. And for all intents and purposes, he's Michael Bay light. Or at least for the time he was. I kind of think of Zack Snyder as Michael Bay light. Now, and I hate him 100 times worse than I do Stephen Sommers. The first Mummy movie is pretty good. I didn't care for the sequel. Van Helsing is speaking of this bad CGI. That Van Helsing has some of the worst CGI I've ever seen in a fucking movie ever. The part where effeminate Dracula like is walking up the wall. That's terrible. We have them convening, and this is the whole, well, blah, 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 I'm not supposed to be here, but I'm going to make my play to join this elite team. It just happens way too easily that we're two guys. Yeah, we're like a part of NATO, but we need to join this team. We want to join this team. Well, too bad. But then, like, 5 minutes goes by. Okay, you can join us. point I'm driving at, this movie was not written very well. Speaking of which, three people wrote this screenplay, and three other people came up with the story, one of which was Stephen Sommers. I didn't bother looking into what else they had written or anything like that, but I can attest the fact that if this is them at their best, that I sure as hell don't want to see what they've done at their worst. Interestingly, one of our side characters here, I want to get his name correct. Yeah, hell, I'll look in the other part. I'll read another review while I'm searching for this. Alright, better mind you again, this is a positive one. This is Simon Foster. As is usually the case, the seething bad guys make for far more interesting on-screen characters than the heroes. To a point, I'll agree with that. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who hasn't shown up yet, plays Rex Lewis, a.k.a. the Doctor, a.k.a. Cobra Commander. At least his performance is... he's alive. I mean, he's not falling back on, I'm reading my lines and phoning it in. Man, Sienna Miller, whatever push-up bra they have given her is magnificent, because she has zero going on up top normally. And I actually think they made her less attractive by making her dark-haired. And I'm usually a dark-haired guy. I don't care for blondes, but I think they made her less attractive, at least above the neck. She's married. Here's a slight connection to actual continuity. Married to the Baron de Cobre, and her being Anastasia de Cobre, where your link to how Cobra gets their name. Arnold Vosloo, who was the titular mummy in Stephen Sommers' The Mummy, playing Zartan. I actually think he's not a terrible casting choice. And for years, like before this came out, Billy Zane evidently had been interested in playing Zartan, which is kind of cool. I never picked him as a G.I. Joe fan. The funny thing is that Arnold Vosloo and Billy Zane are constantly being confused for each other. Here we have Joseph Gordon-Levitt making his on-screen debut as the Doctor. I have so many aesthetic problems with this movie. You know, when Cobra Commander finally shows up, which is like the last 2 or 3, 5 minutes of the movie, they make him look like a fucking Ninja Turtle, like a chrome Ninja Turtle. And I heard that, like, they were kind of had a reservation about making this movie accurate to the comic, aesthetically, to Cobra Commander with the hood, because they thought people would draw comparisons to... oh, the CGI is terrible. But they thought people would draw comparisons to Cobra Commander and the KKK. And, okay, if you don't want to draw comparisons to something negative to a hero, I get that. But why would you care about drawing comparisons to a character in the KKK? He's a villain! He's supposed to be evil! If you want to get someone over as a bad guy, that's a pretty good route of associating with a white supremacist group. And in some terms, I guess there might be political drawbacks, but that's just the... I mean, this is before the world became, like, as politically correct as it is now. So, I don't get it. In the sequel, they give him the helmet. I mean, he's not the Cobra Commander look that I would have gone for, but I give them credit for taking something on page or in animated form and putting it into a cinematic version that both is a homage to its source material and is something, you know, more cinematic. So that's a nice thing about the sequel. So Cobra, they want to destroy some shit with these nano robots. As you'll see later on, they go to Paris and destroy Paris. And why G.I. Joe wouldn't just let them is beyond me, because a bunch of snail-eating escargot, wine-drinking pansies should be able to take care of themselves, but evidently G.I. Joe has to wipe up their problems. There's always this weird inherent nature of G.I. Joe to do their jobs, unfortunately, sometimes with conflicting results. There's an episode of the cartoon, and I want to say it's in the first season, where Cobra's scheme of the week is that they have a laser where, if memory serves correctly, they take this laser and they shoot the moon, and they draw like the image of Cobra Commander on the moon to strike fear into the world, so everyone will constantly be under the watchful eye of Cobra Commander. And the way G.I. Joe solves this problem is not by stopping Cobra per se. It's more so that, well, we're going to take your laser and we're going to mark Cobra Commander's face out and write G.I. Joe on the moon. That's the same fucking thing! You solved the problem by doing the same thing. We don't own the moon! Cobra doesn't own the moon, G.I. Joe doesn't own the moon. It's frustrating. So frustrating. So here we are. This is, I'm assuming this is supposed to be the Baron de Cobra. So far, Sienna Miller has gotten just as much screen time as anybody else in this movie. So this, the development of this movie started back in 1994. Shows you how long it takes things to get off the ground. Which, if this movie had been made in the 90s, it very well could have been worse. So, kudos to them for waiting more than a decade to get this off the ground. Speaking of which, this movie came out August 7th, 2009. It had a $175 million budget, and its box office, it did pretty well, $302.5 million. I'm ashamed to say that, you know, whatever $11-$12 bucks I contributed to that. Saw this movie at Turkey Creek in Knoxville, the IMAX theater. Was excited in the sense that I'd wanted this my entire life, but I knew it was going to be bad. And one of my good friends, Jason Davis, shout out. Also a G.I. Joe fan growing up. He and I and some other people I worked with, we saw the early showing. So we may have actually seen it on the 6th. I might be a little off on my timeline there. But if it weren't for the fact that I wasn't driving, I would have got up and left. By the point that they make it to the desert in Egypt, I'm already, like, fuming. And at this point in the movie, where you're seeing Duke propose to what later becomes the Baroness, my eyes are rolling so far in the back of my head, I could see my stomach. So, let's read some trivia to pad this shit out, because nothing important is happening in the movie. Well, nothing will important will happen. Ripcord says, "You have lifelike hair and a kung fu grip." Hasbro used the same line in TV commercials for the original G.I. Joe action figures. Those being the 12-inch dolls, not per se based off the real American line that lasted from 82 till, I want to say, 94. Has been relaunched a couple of times. Rachel Nichols burned herself and Sierra Miller sprained her wrist while shooting the fight between Scarlet and Baroness. Well, I wish someone had burned every print of this movie so I wouldn't have had to seen it and sprained her wrist. I wish you would have sprained the wrist of the camera operator so it wouldn't have been filmed in the first place. Sienna Miller took the role of the Baroness because it did not involve having a breakdown or being addicted to heroin, dying at the end. It was something that was just maybe really great fun. Well, I hope you had fun ruining so many people's childhood. Oh, by the way, wasn't she married to Jude Law? I hate Jude Law. Jude Law's face offends me on like levels I can't even describe verbally. Why do women find him attractive? He looks like his face has been squished by a hot frying pan. And his receding hairline's worse than mine. So fuck you. Fuck you, Jude Law. Plus you're a shitty actor. He's probably not. I don't watch Jude Law movies. I don't know. Ray Park was nervous about wearing the ninja suit and asked to practice with it at home so he could be comfortable with it. He found the suit uncomfortable. It was like wearing a rubber band. He had to put effort into moving in it. I don't care about that. Oh, this is a good one. A post-credit scene was planned in which famously mute ninja Snake Eyes tells a joke to the G.I. Joe team. Larry Hama, thank God, and shout out to Larry Hama. I got to meet him at a Fanboy Expo in Knoxville this past year. Cool guy. He autographed number 1 and number 21, the infamous silent issue of G.I. Joe comics. But thankfully, they brought him on as a consultant in the film, and he actually shows up later on in a cameo. You can just see him for a half a second. But he was like, "Yeah, this is a terrible idea." And depending on what there's Brendan Fraser and his unnamed cameo, but he's obviously supposed to be Flint by what he's wearing. Depending on what origin you go with Snake Eyes, whether it be he took a vow of silence or, an arrow hit him in the throat because of defending the Arashikage master, whatever reason, it doesn't make any sense character-wise for him to say anything. So thank God that didn't happen, because I probably would have been, I was already white-knuckling, hurry for this freaking movie to be over. But at that point, I would have been so angry that, I don't know that I could have restrained myself. I probably would have walked up, found the dude at the ticket booth, and demanded that he take me to the projection screen so I could have removed the cancer from the eyes of the people enduring it. Alright, more. Dennis Quaid took the role of General Hawk on the insistence of his son, a G.I. Joe fan. Well, Dennis Quaid's son, I hope that you, in time, have realized the mistakes that you've thrust upon the world. I hope you've apologized not only to your father, but I hope if you were a genuine G.I. Joe fan, I hope you didn't find any pleasure in adding to the legacy of bad G.I. Joe cinema, arguably the worst atrocity that has happened to mankind in regards to our fictional military service. Sorry, I had to take a drink. The scar under Duke's right eye is an homage to a famous scar on the original 12-inch G.I. Joe figure introduced in 1964. It was adopted as a copyright mark to prevent unlawful reproduction. That's true. Yet again, not relevant to the American hero line. But thanks for referencing that, I guess. Rachel Nichols was the first choice for the role of Scarlett O'Hara. Well, whoop-de-frickin'-do. Man, she's nice looking. I have a thing for redheaded girls. But I just don't think they captured the essence of Scarlett in, like, any way. Scarlett was a really, really not... movie, quote-unquote, tough girls are bitchy and standoffish and, like, they're real ball busters. But that's not the strength of a woman. Scarlett was a three-dimensional character in the comic book. Not to mention that she has this serious relationship with Snake Eyes, a man who is mute. So there's a depth of character there that they... Even with a well-written script, I don't know if they could have really captured. Oh my god, this CGI. I am not even making this up. I have seen fan films, not necessarily G.I. Joe fan films, I have seen fan films made with iPhones that have better CGI in this movie. Jesus fucking Christ. Oh my god, look at this. This is like a cutscene from a PS2 video game. And not even a good one. See, it's funny because they scared people. He was riding a camel and they're in Egypt because they don't have cars in Egypt. Ugh. One page down. Sam Worthington was considered for the role of Duke, but turned it down due to scheduling conflicts with Avatar. Well, that shows you how long Avatar was in production, because this movie probably shot in... It may have been shooting at the beginning of 2009. Eh, who knows. Yeah, Sam Worthington. Well, he was in Terminator Salvation. He was, the MacGuffin of the story. He was the Terminator that was part human. I don't know. That movie's stupid. To prepare for her role as the Baroness, Sienna Miller spent 4 hours in weight training and boxing and learned to fire live ammunition. So she learned to pull a fucking trigger? Good for you. I'm glad you spent valuable money that could have went into the pockets of cancer patients or fed the bellies of starving Ethiopian children so you can learn to do what is inherent for an opposable thumb. You pulled a trigger. How stupid are you? Now granted, she probably weighs like 100 pounds, but there's a movie called Marathon Man. It's a terrific movie. Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier are in this film. And I'd heard this wonderful story that in preparation for this, you know, Dustin Hoffman wanting to show his acting chops, you know, be method. He stayed up for, you know, like 48 hours. It's just so, when they're filming, like, he can really sell the fact that he's so tired. And the great thing about this is that Laurence Olivier, you know, one of the great actors of all time, sees him and he's like, "Hey, you look terrible." And he's like, "You know, what's up?" And Dustin Hoffman tells him, like, "Oh, well, you know, I've been up for 48 hours, you know, preparing for this role." And Laurence Olivier says, "You're an actor. Just act like you're tired." And he's completely right. Marlon Brando was the same way. Like, he, one of the greatest actors of all time, one of the greatest screen performances ever, Don Corleone. And he never took acting seriously. When you take acting so seriously, like Daniel Day-Lewis on, you know, was it My Left Foot? Is that what that movie's called? About where he would, on set, he would make people carry him around because he could not break character. Like Heath Ledger's Joker, which, hot button issue with me, folks. I think The Dark Knight is a great movie. I think Heath Ledger's performance is pretty good. I don't feel it was necessarily Oscar-worthy in the sense. Like, if he'd been alive, like, I would have been fine with it. I don't like posthumous Oscars. It should have gone to Robert Downey for Tropic Thunder. Great performance. Super underrated. But this whole idea of method acting is just insulting. And Sienna Miller, I keep calling her Sierra. Sienna Miller, I applaud her for taking her quote unquote craft so seriously that she felt it necessary. She had to take arms training, live ammunition training. It's insulting. Storm Shadow is one of the few things I like about this movie. I thought he was well cast. Not an entire callback, but Storm Shadow bites the dust in this film and is resurrected in the sequel, which actually does happen in the comic book. Here we have a flashback. Oh, just to remind the people watching this movie who have no idea what this shit's about, that they have a past Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes. In American culture, you know, we associate white as, you know, virtuous and good, and black as, you know, demonic and evil. Well, in Japan, it's the complete opposite. White is evil, and black is virtuous. You see this a lot in professional wrestling, which I'm a big fan of, or at least I used to be. I like the cool yin-yang kind of relationship between Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes, and the reflection of, you know, their color palette being indicative of Japanese culture. A lot of the later issues of G.I. Joe, like, I want to talk, like, in, like, the 130 to 150 range of issues, they became very Storm Shadow, not Storm Shadow, but Snake Eyes heavy. And, that was certainly a decline. He was the most popular character. I mean, what kid in the 80s and early 90s didn't want to be a ninja? And Snake Eyes, such a popular character. But for me, I've always been a villains guy, so Storm Shadow gets the nod from me. You know, I'm not gonna lie, this part of the movie is the closest it becomes, or it gets to being watchable, and it's just because, like, they're having fun with it. And in that regard, I don't think Stephen Sommers was the worst choice for director. Just like how Michael Bay, like in the first Transformers movie, like all the scenes with the Autobots, you know, they're well done. When you put a human on screen, he gets super, super out of his element. But Stephen Sommers can direct people under the right circumstances. It's just usually not when dialogue of any substance is coming out of their mouth. Oh, there's Zartan, there's Camel. So, because that was just, you know, ridiculous set piece of, you know, people shooting each other, that was fine. It was just enough, you know, ridiculousness you'd expect from a G.I. Joe movie. But now we have to get back into the plot. And you just saw him, but that was Jonathan Pryce playing the president, which what little continuity goes from the first movie to the second movie is he's replaced by Zartan, and slowly but surely, after the capture of Cobra Commander and Destro and all this, he manages to pull the strings, because he's the president, to get them out. Which, if you really think about it, doesn't make a lot of sense compared to how this movie ends, because Cobra Commander is suddenly like, okay, call me Commander. Okay, no one under you should respect your authority because you haven't been in charge until now, and literally no one saw you become in charge. So why would they follow you or go to the trouble of... It's just stupid. Marlon Wayans... Here, more trivia. I just had it, and I've lost it. Marlon Wayans was in Requiem for a Dream, which is a super depressing movie. Not the kind of depression I'm going to go into after having to sit here and watch this. The kind of depressing movie that actually has substance to it. Not a movie that I have any aspirations to watch over and over again. But he showed some acting range in that. And supposedly that's why they... Oh yeah, Marlon Wayans was cast as Ripcord after his performance in Requiem for a Dream. Wayans is also a fan of G.I. Joe. Well, I don't... If you're really a fan of G.I. Joe, like, and you read this script, like, how... Are you really? Like, how could you demean yourself or the brand? It just makes me wonder, like, did they change shit on the fly? At one point, was there something to this script? Because I know it was in development hell for a long time. And they kind of shifted. Because at one point, like, G.I. Joe was going to be, like, fully functional. All the members were there. And it was going to kind of, like, pick up in the middle of things. And then, you know, the whole origin this. And this movie's called The Rise of Cobra, but it very well might as well just be, well, it's the origin of one character you might care about being Duke. And I was never a Duke fan. I always liked Flint better, who shows up in the sequel, but come on, Bruce Campbell was Flint. Bruce Campbell should have been cast as Flint. I had a fan cast. This is my cast. Gary Oldman should have been Cobra Commander. Isn't that fucking insane that would have been? Oscar caliber actor under a mask and let loose. Just think like him from Leon the Professional, where he's just like ripping and roaring and just insane. That would have been so good. You keep Christopher Eccleston as Destro, or shooting from the hip right here, Patrick Stewart. I think Patrick Stewart would have been fucking awesome. Or Sean Connery. Sean Connery wouldn't have done this movie. Thanks a lot, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You ruined, the career of one of our prized possessions in acting history. Another movie that has really bad CGI. Oh, and by the way, anybody who's read League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it's written by Alan Moore. Alan Moore is amazing. He did Watchmen. He had a pretty good run on Swamp Thing. One of the better comic book writers of all time. He did The Killing Joke, which is, you know, lauded as, you know, top five best Batman stories ever. Or at least, probably the best Joker story. Alan Moore is a weird guy. He has so many strange beliefs beyond, anything that, like, his comic book writing and stuff. But in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, there's a scene where there's a very I can't even say that it's graphic because it involves an invisible man, but there's a rape scene that involves the invisible man. It's bizarre. So I highly recommend anybody who wants to have their sensibilities shaken to the ground, go and find a trade paperback, probably the simplest version or simplest way to do it. Track that shit down and read it. Bask in it. There's also a really good documentary on Alan Moore that I would highly recommend if you ever want to be left not understanding how a human being like that believes the shit he believes and yet has survived into old age. Because if I went around talking about believing in magic and things like that, I would have been locked up in a crazy house a long time ago. And I believe some crazy shit. I'm interested in crazy shit, but I don't go spouting it out. Shows what fame can do. So, the marking on Snake Eye's right shoulder comes from the 8 trigrams. The top marking is water. The lower marking is fire. Together in the I Ching symbol means completion. Well, that means diddly dick to me. And I guarantee nobody saw that shit on his shoulder, so who fucking cares? Common was offered the role of Roadblock, but he turned it down. The character was changed to Roadblock's cousin, Heavy Duty, played by Adewale-blah-blah-blah-blah. I'm not reading that name because I can't pronounce it. Why didn't they just let blah 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 play Roadblock? Probably because he couldn't speak a lick of English worth listening to. According to Brian Goldner, the writer took inspiration from mostly Larry Hama's G.I. Joe comics. No, he fucking didn't. Because nothing in this movie happens in the comics. I want to tell you a little story. So, a few years ago, me and my good friend Scott, we were going to a Halloween party. And we're kind of waiting for the rest of our crew to get here. And so, we're having a few drinks. And we both killed a bottle of Jack Daniels. And we're in my entertainment room. And behind me is, you know, my long boxes, most of my comic collection. I say most, but that's not even true. I've got so many boxes in my parents' attic, I can't even get to them. But the majority of my comic collection I have on site here at the Black Lodge. And naturally, as most of my conversations, they turn to one or two things: Ghostbusters, G.I. Joe, metal, or, you know, some other crazy shit. But somehow we got on the subject of G.I. Joe, and he's like, you know, kind of asking me about it. So over the course of like a half an hour, I basically told him the continuing story from issue 1 to issue 155, drunk off my ass. So, my point being is that if he based this off Larry Hama's writing, he did a really shitty job, or he doesn't know how to read, and he was reading Action Force or Action Man or some shit, because he didn't get this shit from the comic books, because then it might have had a chance at being good. We have the obligatory flashback scene. They're in, I'm assuming, Iraq, Fallujah. Who cares? But this is the show, like, oh no, Cobra Commander was in Iraq and we blew him up and he's going to try, no, what a huge explosion. If only it had been real and the film reel would have been engulfed in hellfire for all eternity. The helicopters in the distance look fucking terrible. Steven Summers took great care over the technology depicted in the film, going through various books / magazines about weapons technology. He feels almost 100% of the technology can be developed within 10 to 20 years. Okay, so this was 2009. We're coming up on almost 10 years, and I'm pretty sure that by 2029, we're not going to have nanorobots that can tear down the Eiffel Tower. I'm pretty sure we're not going to have injectable shit that will make soldiers be able to regenerate. We're not going to have super bio suits, and that's coming up. And that's probably where the majority of this rant is going to take shape. Because that was the point where if I had had a bottle of liquor, I would have been instead of psoriasis the liver, you know, by the time the movie was over, because my point being, Steven Summers, you're full of shit. You're not just full of shit, you're full of dog shit. You let a dog shit into your mouth so much that you're full of it. I'm off track, but that's how I feel. Dennis Quaid filmed all his scenes in the first 2 months of production. Well, that's good to know. It impacts me in no way. Page down. There are over 250 explosions in the movie, and not one of them is memorable. Not a one. The Cobra nanomites, which decay metal, are colored green to resemble fungus, which also can decay metal. Yeah, that's fungus, all right. Snake Eyes' pursuit in Paris described him as a man who never gives up. Words from the theme of the animated G.I. Joe series. Well, at least that's actually tying to the actual series. Best friends Channing Tatum and Joseph Gordon-Levitt star as Duke and Cobra Commander, who are arch enemies in the film. Are they really friends? That kind of seems weird that they would like quote unquote best friends. That might be true. I've never heard that before. According to Steven Summers, total invisibility is impossible, but the camouflage cameras in the film can allow for virtual invisibility. This year, which is 2017, we had Spider-Man Homecoming, which was actually a pretty good movie. Arguably the best, if not, or maybe second best Spider-Man film of the six. And there's a part towards the end where you have, you know, this aircraft that's Stark Tech. It's, you know, delivering stuff from point A to point B. And it has this sort of invisibility kind of cloak to it. So there is some truth to this. There's a building being built, or maybe even has been built, that is going to have not necessarily an invisibility wall, but it's going to have a camera projection on it to where it will project what's behind it on the front of it. So it's going to have like an all mirror face, and if you look at it, it'll look like you're just staring at the sky, which is kind of a cool idea. So to that, I will cop. Oh boy, here we go. So you're about to have your obligatory chase scene, which is one of the big problems with this movie in its conception. Was number one, they were afraid to acknowledge the American roots of G.I. Joe. And two, there was this effort by Hasbro to make it more global, and an Action Man, which is sort of like the UK version of G.I. Joe, make it, oh Jesus, bad joke, to make it more universal for European fans by including Action Man. Well, thankfully that was kiboshed, but this is the holdover for us. So you've got these stupid ass suits. G.I. Joe had all kinds of stupid technology that would never exist. The pogo pod is one of my favorites. Cool ass toy. But these like accelerator suits. Number one, why would you give these multi-billion dollar expensive costumes to the two new guys on the team? Would you not give these to, like, okay, we have special trained guys who, A, have used these before, B, who've been with the team longer than, like, a day, but no, we're gonna give them to the two new guys just because plot convenience. The Blues Brothers is one of my all-time favorite movies. And aside from the, like, Bullet and The Great Escape, French Connection, you know, it has one of the best chase scenes in a movie ever. And I think, like, film history classes. I mean, there's a handful of these chasings that they'll show as like what works in the context of a movie. This chase scene is all flash and no substance. The French Connection is literally just Popeye Doyle chasing above street tram or subway car, and it's the editing, you know, the score, it's just him trying to, you know, to keep up with it. The Blues Brothers, I guess in context, is more similar to this, and that it's just ridiculousness for the sake of ridiculousness. The difference being is that everything that happens in the Blues Brothers is actually fucking happening. Nothing is happening in this movie. Yeah, they probably flip some cars over, and the explosions are real, but the CGI-laden green screen bullshit is... it's an offense to my eyes. Stupid mouth on Snake Eyes is... The second movie, they made his costume a lot more, a lot less goofy looking. And the costume actually looks fine other than the mouth. But it's in such like a semi-puckered face. It's always like he's like getting ready to kiss somebody. This whole budding romance between Ripcord and Scarlet makes no sense. Number one, because they have no time to develop it. Number two, all I know about her character is that she's tough and a bitch. And why would he want... I get why he would want to have relations with her, but why would he want... poor screenwriting. Here's your shot from the trailer. You gotta have the Matrix slow-mo shot, which by this point was like a decade old. Haha, you got hurt. Okay, you have this group, this international group. Why is there no air support when this is going on? Like, why are there no helicopters? Why are there no jets? I get it, you know, it's a crowded street in Paris. But, I mean, if you're willing to let these two morons jump around in these low-rent Iron Man suits and destroy all kinds of shit and hurt lots of civilians in the process, like, wouldn't it make more sense to shoot one missile from an aircraft to stop this immediately rather than like, well, let's just play it by ear and see how these motherfuckers do on the fly. Yeah, he gave up. No, he didn't. Ugh. The film's title, The Rise of Cobra, is a reference to The Revenge of Cobra, the second story arc in G.I. Joe. No, it's not. That's just you putting two and two together. Dwayne Johnson, a.k.a. The Rock, was rumored to appear in the film as Shipwreck. He would later appear as Roadblock in the sequel. Roadblock casting makes more sense than Shipwreck, but I think The Rock was probably glad he was not in this movie. Why did he take the sequel? I know he's sort of like he's kind of become what Will Smith was in the 90s. He's a hugely bankable star, super charismatic. I get why people like him. He's become kind of like a franchise reviver or a franchise saver, although they haven't gone forward with the third G.I. Joe movie. Speaking of which, oh my god, there are preliminary plans to do, I guess, a soft reboot of the G.I. Joe franchise, which may actually end up being worse than this movie, and
that is terrifying on a level that I can't even comprehend. And it's going to be millennial-centric, and I grew up as a part of Generation X. That's terrible enough. A bunch of the 90s equivalent of hippies, and entitled pricks who rape the welfare system because they're too lazy to get off their ass and have a real job, and then their kids, this millennial generation, or this the most entitled generation of people in history, who get butthurt if you sneeze in their direction or have a dissenting opinion. You probably love this movie. Jackholes. The Paris action scenes were filmed in 14 days in the Czech Republic. Shout out to Martin, he's a J1 student to work with over this course of this summer. He's from the Czech Republic. I'll be kind of curious to ask him about. He was probably in diapers when this movie was made, but see if he knows anything about when this movie was filmed. Filmmakers built shops of flowers, changed school names, and parked many old French manufactured cars in the area. The Baron's Laboratory was filmed in the headquarters of the big company Saska. I have no idea what that is. The Baroness derisively calls Duke and Ripcord real American heroes, the tagline of the G.I. Joe series, which would have been clever had they been an American force in this film. Just so happens they're both American. Oh no, and now the nanites are going to destroy the Eiffel Tower. Ugh. I realize CGI is coming a long way, especially since then, but as I referenced earlier, this was a $175 million movie. They really could have spent more, shifted some of that money to the film CGI, because it was outdated then, and it is really outdated now. So, with destroying the Eiffel Tower, which I joke you not, got not so much a round of applause, but did get a big hearty laugh in the near sold-out crowd when I saw this in the theater. It made me laugh because I'm not a big fan of France. But I don't think that's necessarily why people were laughing. It's just, it looks so bad. Congratulations, Duke. You just saved Paris. Now Storm Shadow's going to punch you out. 112 cars were crashed during filming. This breached the previous world record of 104 cars crashed during the making of the Blues Brothers 2000 in 1998. The figure of 112 does not include cars that were blown up. So as I was saying earlier about, like, you know, the cars flipping and stuff, that was all real, but a lot of the surroundings, it was all CGI nonsense. The G.I. Joe saga has frequently had Snake Eyes become mute through damage to his throat from an attack. In this, he is mute, but not by damage, but by taking a vow of silence to honor his slain master. I referenced that a little earlier. The film takes place in 2020. So we're a little, about 2.5 years away from... 2.5 years away from the world that this is going to encompass. Skip Woods wrote an early draft of the film, which featured Alex Mann, a.k.a. Britain's Action Man, and the evil ninja Ryan. I'm not making that up. An evil ninja named Ryan. Scarlet is married to Action Man, but still has feelings for Duke and is killed by the Baroness. Snake Eyes speaks at the start, but his vocal cords are slashed during the story, rendering him mute. Well, to be honest, it wouldn't have been any worse than the movie we got, but that was a really stupid idea. They wanted Mark Wahlberg to play Duke initially, and I've come to like Channing Tatum in comedic roles, because he has genuine timing. He's very funny, very charismatic. But if Channing Tatum gets cast in an action movie, I have zero interest in it. So I don't know if Mark Wahlberg turned it down, or, you know, they never got to the stage of asking him to do it. But, I mean, it's a good thing he didn't do this movie. But Mark Wahlberg's another guy who has great comic timing, but I can take him a little more seriously in an action role. It's not that Channing Tatum was not cut out to be an action star. He's got the look. I don't know. He's just too douchey for my... And Mark Wahlberg's a douche too, but I can look at him and say, okay, he resembles a badass. He's not just some, you know, underwear model. The accelerator suits are designated Delta 6. This is a reference to the similarly designated series Sigma, G.I. Joe Sigma 6, which fans affectionately call Sigma Sucks, because it was a terrible cartoon that either came out right before this. Yeah, it was 2005. Crappy animation style. Not very good. Cool figures, though. When given a painkiller on the G.I. Joe transport after Ripcord and Duke's unit is ambushed, Ripcord jokes that Duke was government issued, which is what the G.I. Joe stands for. Huh. Don Murphy was going to produce the film in 2003, but he made Transformers in 2007 instead. And this movie actually has the same cinematographer as Transformers. Despite its many flaws, I will defend the first Transformers movie on most parts. I think overall it's an enjoyable movie. All the sequels are terrible. But the reason the first Transformers movie gets a pass from me, there's a great scene where Sam Witwicky and his family, you know, they're in their house, and the Transformers are all in the backyard. And the whole comedy comes from them kind of trying to hide and him, you know, kind of diverting his parents from seeing. There's a great sense of fun in that scene, and that's something that really lacks in Michael Bay movies. It either takes the source material too seriously or not seriously enough. Usually tone and poor character development is the killer of those movies. All of this backstory with Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow is inherent to the characters and the motivations in the comic book. I mean, a lot of the story arcs, you know, have them intertwining, and Storm Shadow kind of bounces back and forth between a good guy and a bad guy. And he does have a code of ethics. But, you know, a 2-minute flashback scene in a poorly made movie doesn't do the trick. Hey, Brendan Fraser's character was meant to be the Joe Soldier Gung-Ho, but since that was character was a Cajun of origin, which Fraser definitely was not, he was renamed Sergeant Stone. Okay. There's some truth to this, because I remember at the time reading into this, but if you look at him earlier in the film, he's very, very obviously Flint. I mean, he's wearing Flint's outfit. So I think this was an example of the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing. Speaking of the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing, this, and I've harped on this a lot, but the CGI is unwatchable. Those fish look like shit. You remember like the MS-DOS days where, you know, where having a screensaver on your computer was like a big deal? That was the type of like cutting edge special effects you would have seen in fish floating by on a Hewlett-Packard 1995 computer. By the way, I apologize for stuttering over my words, but I'm lubricating my insides to make it through this. So here we have the Night Raven, which is an actual G.I. Joe or a Cobra vehicle. And later on, Ripcord flies it, and there's a helmet that flies on his head that is very specifically designed to look like Wild Weasel. Awesome G.I. or Cobra villain character. So somebody involved with this was throwing in a detail here or there that actually homages things from the series. But nobody was doing a good job. So we're like an hour into the movie, and we've had two big action set pieces, no character development, with the exception of, I guess, Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow. They've tried to, and I guess they've tried to give Duke and Baroness's relationship a little bit of breathing room. Nobody gives a shit about it, so it ultimately doesn't matter. This stupid thing that he's wearing his head. Why? So, I live in Sevierville, Tennessee, you know, which is down the road from Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, which is down the road from Gatlinburg, Tennessee. The character he's portraying is supposed to be from Gatlinburg. And that's that was always kind of a cool thing growing up, being able to reference that. But it doesn't really amount to much. I mean, I guess this movie really hasn't had a lasting impression on people. Oh, no. I kiss my girlfriend, who might as well be a different person because she looks completely different. Her boobs are bigger now. I mean, this movie was fairly successful, but I mean, it took a long time to get the sequel off the ground. I think a lot of people went and saw this for nostalgia's sake, but its reception was pretty negative. So they sort of planted the seeds for a lot of things with the intent of this being a jumping off point, which they threw a lot of that away with the sequel, thankfully, because most of the things in this movie don't amount to much. But these origin stories usually suck because they don't deliver on the name. Like, yeah, there is a group called G.I. Joe, and you do see the quote-unquote rise of Cobra, but they don't really become Cobra. Because as far as I'm concerned, this is still just the Mars Corporation. which Destro is not a member of Cobra. His services go to the highest bidder. Now, he's generally associated with Cobra, but by and large, you know, his corporation is separate from that. So the whole timeline of this makes no sense. Emma Roberts turned down the role of Scarlet. Well, good for Emma Roberts, because she's a decent actress and probably should not have wanted to work on such a turd of a movie. Matthew Fox and Chris Evans were considered for the role of Duke before Channing Tatum was cast. Chris Evans has gone on quite successfully to be Captain America. Matthew Fox, he was in Lost. I really don't know what he's been in. You'll have to tell me that, because I really don't know. Gary Daniels and Scott Atkins auditioned for the role of Snake Eyes. I don't have a fucking clue who either one of those are. I'm sure they're probably a martial artist. The use of quote-unquote solid holograms is based on Hasbro's other franchise, Jim, which had a heroine who used holograms. Jim would later go on to get her own film, Jim and the Holograms. Oh my god, it was directed by John M. Chu. This is the guy that did the sequel to G.I. Joe. Okay, Jim and the Holograms. It has a cult following. This girl who has a computer that called Synergy, and she has a band, but like she's kind of like the Hannah Montana of the 80s. She would push a button in her earring, and then it would make her into Jim, and Jim would perform. But there's this group called the Misfits. Not, you know, Jerry Only and Danzig, which would have been friggin' awesome, but no. This female group of musicians who are routinely causing trouble. Like, why would it be up to a band to stop crime? But whatever. So, you have an interesting premise for a cartoon, and for what it was, it's pretty entertaining. I'm not gonna lie. I like Jim growing up. Well, a couple years ago, they released a Jim and the Holograms movie and abandoned everything about it that made it interesting, kept the name. There's no computer, there's no real opposition, and made it a movie about a girl gaining fame through YouTube. It grossed so little, it was barely in theaters for like 2 weeks. So, I guess all things considering, G.I. Joe maybe was not handled as poorly as it could have been. Ha ha ha. The comedy in this movie is non-existent. I don't remember where it I know it happens at some point in this movie and coming up, but there's a part where Heavy Duty yells Yo Joe. That was the only point where, other than unintentionally laughing at stupid shit in the movie, it's the only time watching the movie live with a group that people actually kind of rallied. You know, there was kind of like, yeah. The movie has a body count of 186. That's surprising, because other than one or two people getting stabbed at the beginning, I can't remember. Stephen Sommers felt that this was the closest he would get to making a James Bond film. The film contains homages to several 007 films. Goldfinger, the Baroness wears a leather suit with an evening dress underneath. She also utilizes a weapon-laden automobile in Paris. Well, Goldfinger is a terrific movie. I love James Bond. And James Bond, this is not. Thunderball, a climactic battle at an underwater lair occurs. Well, that's kind of going on. right now. Oh, here, this is the Dr. Mindbender character, and you're getting to see the origin of this version of G.I. Joe's Cobra Commander. Cobra Commander is a used car salesman. A disillusioned person who, through a bunch of pyramid schemes, forges an empire. He's a very interesting character. He has a son. He almost gives up the life of crime when his son Billy is caught in the crossfire of it. There's a lot of interesting character development that goes on in the comics, but as goofy as the cartoons, at least he was a well-defined character. This just seems like Scooby-Doo shit. You have... Christopher Eggleston looks like a villain. And I think, like, if you hadn't waited till, like, the last 5 minutes of the movie to put him, you know, inject him and give him a metal face, which that's was their way of incorporating their MacGuffin into this, you know, the story is giving him the metal face by injecting him with the nanomites. But to me, Destro was a awesome character, despite, you know, wearing a ridiculous mask, not for having a functional living metal mask. Fun story, and I'm blanking on his name, the actor, voice actor of Destro was at a convention I went to recently, and at first, I didn't recognize him because he was away from his booth. He's just this African American gentleman with, you know, sort of disheveled hair, and he was screaming "No!" kind of like Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith. And what it was there's a couple of people that, you know, had requested him yell "No" as Destro. But as this is going on, I'm like, what the hell is going on? And it was later on I realized, like, saw him at the table, say, okay, that makes perfect sense. And I felt kind of shitty that I didn't pick up on that. Like, you know, I know, oh, she kisses Ripcord. Oh, suddenly we like each other. We've spent all of total of 20 minutes in each other's presence. Oh, the Night Raven. Cool toy. The CGI is terrible. All right, back to the Bond references. You Only Live Twice. A ninja training school appears. Well, that's pretty basic. I have to admit, Storm Shadow's winter Arctic attire was kind of cool. There are moments where Joseph Gordon-Levitt's voice, he's almost starting to slip into the Cobra Commander, you know, the Chris Latta, real American hero Cobra Commander. Why all of a sudden is she back to normal? Oh, just do it. Blah, blah, blah. Cobra Commander's appearance in this film is... Hold on. Cobra Commander's appearance is based on his appearance in G.I. Joe the movie, a disfigured scientist, and on the Cobra Soldiers, Major Blood, a one-eyed former soldier, and Dr. Mindbender, a monocle-wearing... expert of mind control. So basically they just threw a bunch of nonsense together. Yeah. During the fight in the underground base, a screen is seen briefly with a map looking oddly like the Millennium Falcon. Next scene shows a door closing just before troops can enter. I have no idea where that's at. That would require effort on my part to look for it. The Eiffel Tower is destroyed by the nanomites by Cobra. In the miniseries G.I. Joe, a real American hero, Cobra uses the mass device to make the Eiffel Tower disappear. The mass device, that was the first story arc of the G.I. Joe series. And it's far more interesting than anything that happens in this movie. The second one, The Revenge of Cobra, that one's my personal favorite. I would recommend, if you absolutely have to watch, you know, something G.I. Joe, that would probably be where I would start. Where are my reviews? Let's read some more reviews of this film. Brian Orndorff. Joe is the latest bloated float in summer's sad parade of cinematic shame. A glorified canon film production with a nasty case of ADD. I take offense to that, because if Canon Films had made this movie, it would have had a fourth of the budget, and it probably would not hold up now, but at the time, it would have been enjoyable as hell, because it would have had Chuck Norris, and it would have had Charles Bronson in it. Joseph Zito would have directed it, and it would have been awesome. I would have killed to have seen that movie. I mean, just think, an actual G.I. Joe live-action movie in the 80s, they made Masters of the Universe, which is a hot property, and Canon Films made that movie. And that movie had a higher budget than what Canon usually made. And I have to say that movie would have been successful had it come out a few years earlier. It would not say it's a good movie, but it would have been successful. They just waited too long. At 1985, 84, if there had been a live-action G.I. Joe movie made by Canon, it would have been a huge hit. Huge. Sam Bath. G.I. Joe, Rise of Cobra is a very throwaway experience, likely to be forgotten by the film world very quickly. Very true. Prophetic, because it has. Mark Pfeiffer. G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra is like a term paper that fulfills the world count requirement and drops in key phrases to demonstrate some familiarity with the material, but is largely filler. That's true. I think this movie has one good sequence, and then a bunch of other shit happens to pad it out for time. Wesley Lowell says, conveniently written and occasionally fun. That's the best review I've read so far. Sean Axemaker, it's actually better. Not nearly as awful, is closer to correct, than the recent Transformers sequel, and significantly shorter to boot. The sequel to Transformers, I think, is probably objectionably more offensive. But this is a worse movie. This movie is incoherent. That movie at least had a semblance of a plot. It just had a bunch of stupid shit thrown in it. Because Michael Bay has a terrible sense of humor. You know, the clanging ball breaker nuts on the Transformer. And the two racist stereotype Autobots in the desert. Hilarious. Airily. Glad we didn't pay full price for movie tickets. Yet again, that's technically a good review for this movie. Alright, Jeffrey Chin. Light entertainment with little to call memorable, but at least Therein exists some detachable evidence that the filmmakers had a soft spot for G.I. Joe and simply wanted to deliver in its essence to the screen. I don't agree with that in the least. Andrea Chase, expensively produced escapist fantasy designed to protect the delicate sensibilities of the kids while never for a moment taxing their budding critical thinking skills. Well, that's true, because there was no point in this movie that I thought of anything critical. The closest I got to thinking during this movie was thinking, like, why in the hell did I spend $11-$12 on this when I very easily could have stayed at home and have flipped through a 30-year-old comic book and got just as much enjoyment out of it. This review's in French. Un film black que hablé aca logue blah 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 blah. Physique au narrative. I'm assuming that's positive. So, kudos, Steven Summers. You made some French bastard happy. David Nusser, a typically frantic actioner from Steven Summers. Okay. David Cornelius, this is an action film highlight reel with any sense of a story or purpose shovel to its current. I think that's supposed to say without. Okay, whatever. This is a top critic. Cliff Dorickson from the Chicago Reader. Loud, shiny, and critic-proof, this franchise launcher is basically Transformers minus the humanity. Ouch. Because there is no humanity in Transformers. Russ Brimer. There are bound to be some 10-year-olds who will shout a hefty Yo, Joe! No, there were not. Because at this point, there were no 10-year-olds into G.I. Joe. So I disagree with you on that. The rest of us will more likely be crying saying it ain't so, Joe. I agree with you on that. Alright, Austin Kennedy. Fans will be disappointed unless they're so desperate that they'll like anything that says G.I. Joe movie. There was a point in my life where I probably was that desperate. Thankfully, I was an adult by the point this movie came out, so I had critical eyes upon it and realized it was a turd from the get-go. The folks at Hasbro must be laughing all the way to the bank this summer. That's probably true, and that's Linda Cook from Quad City Times, Davenport, Iowa. They did make a lot of money on this movie. Jeff Baer, this is my favorite bad movie of the summer. And yes, I realize that's a backhanded compliment. Yo, Joe. Yet again, all of these positive comments. I don't know how this movie got greenlit, really. They relaunched the action figures after being dormant. I was working in a KB Toys at the time, and I mean, I was super stoked because I had first crack at them, and they were releasing these two packs, and for the first time ever, they changed the construction of the figures from having, you know, the rubber band interior waist and the swivel hips and all that to a more standard, like, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 points of articulation kind of figure. And he was just like the straight sit down hips, and whereas I liked that first line, they were not exactly what I would call up to snuff with the G.I. Joes of my childhood. But they're, by all intents and purposes, like, they didn't sell very well, and they tried to relaunch G.I. Joe with, you know, Spy Troops, which is a direct-to-video movie, and Valor vs. Venom, but it never really caught on. So I don't even know how this movie got greenlit so far after G.I. Joe's relevancy on a mainstream sense. But it did. And this is what we got. The good thing about having all this research in front of me is I've paid very little attention to this movie, so this has been a lot more tolerable than it really could have been. Stupid explosions, and here's our I commend them for not revealing Snake Eyes' face at any point during this movie. It's really an epidemic of any kind of superhero movie, and I guess in a sense this is sort of in that genre where, you know, they had to get Snake or Storm Shadow rather out of his costume, and they had to show his face. And kudos to Ray Park for honoring the character and not being so vain that he had to get his mug out there. So, not all of the reception of this movie was negative. This there's an accolades section right here. Channing Tatum won the Teen Choice Award for Choice Movie Actor Action for his performance as Duke in the film, and also received three other Teen Choice Award nominations: Choice Movie Action, Choice Movie Actress for Sienna Miller, Choice Movie Villain for Joseph Gordon-Levitt. However, the film was also nominated for 6 Razzie Awards, winning Worst Picture, Worst Director, Worst Screenplay, Worst Supporting Actor for Marlon Wayans, and Worst Prequel, Remake, Ripoff, or Sequel. Sequel with Sierra Miller winning the Razzie for Worst Supporting Actress at the 30th Golden Raspberry Awards. Well, until reading this right now, I had no idea about that. So that lets me know at least that people were paying attention to maybe to the quality that this could have been and how short it fell. In other media inspired by the movie The Ballad of G.I. Joe. Okay, this was great. The Ballad of G.I. Joe is a sort of like a music video that Funny or Die produced, and they had all these celebrity cameos, and it was like, if the movie was actually cast, how would you cast it? Well, you've got Henry Rollins as Duke, and Zach Galifianakis as Snow Job, and Julianne Moore is Snake Eyes, and Cobra Commander loves 70s Boogie, and he's a big fan of Three Dog Night. I know that's irrelevant, but it was funny. And Chuck Liddell is Gung Ho. It was perfect. And it shows you, like, in the right hands, like, a G.I. Joe film could have been terrific. But, sadly, I don't think we're ever going to get something that's going to be quite what I've wanted, and I think, you know, to a broad degree, what G.I. Joe fans want. We're coming up on the end of this movie, which can't come quick enough. I'm surprised I've lasted this long. Number one, I've had about 9 beers and I've got to go to the bathroom really badly. But other, for the sake of not just having a big chunk of silence in this commentary, I think I can hold out. I got a man-sized bladder. Oh, that Ballad of G.I. Joe, Vinnie Jones, Vinnie Jones plays Destro, and he plays the clarinet and he does a dance. It's so funny. And it came at the perfect time because I was so angry after seeing this movie that, like, it was... I wouldn't say that, like, it hurt my love of G.I. Joe, like, across the board. But it certainly didn't help. So I needed something to sort of restore my faith in the brand. Alright, let's see. Some more details on this piece of crap. The film was first screened in the U.S. on July 31st, 2009 at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. The premiere was at Hollywood's Grauman Chinese Theater August 7th, 2009. And in the following day, G.I. Joe started playing at 407 theaters in the U.S. along with 35 overseas markets. There was a toy line associated with the movie, and I do own, I want to say, one figure from it. Oddly enough, it's not Cobra Commander. Before I saw the movie, I bought the Dr. Rex Lewis figure, because by this point, like, you know, you can't avoid spoilers. Okay, there's the moment. Yo, Joe, that's the only time the crowd even remotely responded during this movie positively. But I felt, I'm off track. I can't remember what I was talking about. Oh well, I'm sure it probably wasn't important. Nothing in this movie is important. Oh no, Burnt Destro is going to get injected. What comes next? More so. Nanomites. He deserves so much better than this. Okay, well, G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra was released on November 3rd, 2009 on Blu-ray and DVD and regular and two-disc editions. Like, what the hell is on the second disc? Alright, let's look on the back of this Blu-ray. What special features? Commentary by director Steven Summers and producer Bob Duchay. Well, I invite you to listen to their commentary if you want somebody to jerk off the bullshit of this movie off. You know, I just noticed this now. Harry Knowles, you know, sort of like king of the nerds, gave this movie a positive review. It just says awesome on the front. Man, I don't agree with that at all. You've forsaken me. See, look, Cobra Commander. And Destro, for the first time, they show up on screen. This whole idea of, like, we have to tell this very compelling backstory before we get to something familiar is just ridiculous. Ha ha. Oh, look. G.I. Joe showed up. Where the hell were they the entire movie? Like, they have all these forces, yet they don't show up till the last 2 minutes. Oh, no. They locked him up. Like, how... Doesn't it seem like there should have been a scene? Like, there should have been, like, some kind of conflict in, like, capturing him? Cobra Commander, the villain of G.I. Joe doesn't even put up a fight. A character who's very clearly known for retreat, but still, that was the most anticlimactic ending in movie history. Yeah. So, yeah, this Blu-ray has commentary, but evidently there is a special edition version of this movie that has a second disc, probably full with all kinds of great shit that you would want to know about, including two making of featurettes. This was the 10th highest grossing film of 2009, just behind Star Trek Monsters vs. Aliens, X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is an equally terrible movie, by the way. The CGI in that may be slightly better, but that's not saying much. Terminator Salvation, Fast and Furious. That's got to be a typo here, because it's one of the sequels, not the original. A Christmas Carol. I don't even know that. Inglourious Bastards, a good movie. The Proposal, don't know. Blindside, never saw it, but it was highly rated. Well, this was the third film from Hasbro to reach number one at the box office behind Transformers and Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. The Pit. That's what this place is called. Stupid movie. There's your PS2 cutscene. Thank God this piece... Oh, God, it's not over. See, I just got excited because I thought this was over, and then I have the cold, hard reality smack me in the balls that this shit's going to go on for another 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, the president's Zartan. Big fucking... if you paid attention to the movie, which I know half of the people watching it probably fell asleep or have blown their brains out from it. Well, there's your... your red herring. Directed by Stephen Sommers. You can suck a dick, Stephen Sommers. Stuart, Betty, David Elliott, and Paul Lovett. Same to you guys. Well, I survived. I guess that's a positive. And we're just under 2 hours. 2 hours of my life I'll never get back. I hope this was worth it. And for the less than 9 people that listen to this one, this is what you wanted. Wallow your own filth, assholes. Well, signing out from the Black Lodge, it's me, and I'm fucking out of here.